Hello, friends. This is the Environment Show, and welcome.
Hey, it's a good idea, and let's deal with it, but let's deal with it in an intelligent fashion. And shoving a million vehicles down the throats of a potentially unwilling consuming public may be a way of creating another Etzel, one that people will not buy and actually does no good for clean air.
There are two issues here. One is the use of recycled paper in telephone directories, which we would like to see, and that is one issue. The other is to create markets throughout the country so that we can look at programs in every community throughout the United States of recycling telephone directories.
Tim McCarthy at the Washington office of the Motor Vehicle Manufacturers Association, cautiously supporting the idea of alternative fuel vehicles, but not the way we're going about developing them just now. And Joan Leonetti, her organization in Tucson has a way to use old telephone books, and no, they're not to sit on anymore. Those stories and our guests this time on The Environment Show. The Environment Show is a production of WAMC and is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. Well, at long last, we have results from the U.S. House of Representatives on the process of reauthorizing the Clean Air Bill of 1970. Now, H. 3030 must be blended with Senate Bill S. 1630, which was passed earlier in April. The House vote was 401 to 21, while the Senate sent the bill on by a vote of 89 to 11. Though pieces of this legislation go back 10 or more years, according to the Environmental Protection Agency, the real breakthrough came just last July, when President Bush proposed some new legislation.
What's very rewarding for us is that EPA, of course, played a big role in developing the president's legislation.
Robert Brenner is Director of Policy Analysis and Review in the Air Quality Office of the EPA. In other words, Brenner is in charge of reading material on air quality and analyzing that material with respect to EPA policy.
We were the ones who wrote it and shepherded it through the administration process and after the president made his decisions. And then in the Congress, what has just recently passed both the House and Senate is very similar to what the president originally proposed. There are some differences in the details, and there were some modifications made to some of the programs, but the basic structure is very close to what the administration originally proposed. And yes, we do believe that although there's some fine-tuning we would like to do to each of the proposals in conference, that by and large they reflect what we think is necessary to bring the country into attainment for ozone and carbon monoxide in particulates, to reduce toxic emissions and to clean up acid rain.
Though there are some strong similarities between the two pieces of proposed legislation in the House and the Senate, some key differences stand out, differences around which both opponents and proponents are rallying. A side-by-side comparison of the two bills shows major differences over alternative fuel vehicles, the allowable amount of air pollution by factories, and perhaps the most outstanding difference, how to deal with the expected economic impact of the new regulations. The Clean Air Working Group represents several thousand businesses across the nation. Its chief lobbyist and administrator, Bill Fay, says that the House is to be commended for its efforts on behalf of business.
For the first time, the House of Representatives has actually passed an amendment that recognizes the job impacts, the number of people that are going to lose their jobs as a result of passage of a clean air bill. So, you know, we were pleased with the goals that are set out in the bill. There are a number of things that we would change in it because we think that it adopts fairly expensive approaches to those solutions or those goals that we all are trying to achieve. But overall, we think that it's an important part of the process, and we're glad it's moving along.
The House amendment would provide $250 million over 5 years to compensate workers in a variety of industries who would lose part of or all of their jobs because of the new regulations. Specifically, the bill would extend by another 6 months unemployment compensation and also deliver some retraining money. Despite efforts by West Virginia Senator Robert Byrd to provide a similar measure in the Senate, specifically to target coal miners who would lose their jobs if the use of coal were cut back, the Senate did not include a compensation clause. Again, Bill Fay.
We felt it was important that Congress recognize that Americans are going to lose their jobs. You know, and the unfortunate part about this whole thing is that you know, Americans don't want to lose their jobs. And so, you know, for somebody to call this thing a bailout, I think is a real misnomer. The coal miner, the worker in the aluminum plant wants to keep that job and that livelihood. They don't want to have to be retrained for a new job. So whether it's the right amount of money, I don't know, but I think it's a recognition, at least for the first time by Congress, that, hey, these environmental decisions don't come easy, that, in fact, there's a price to pay both competitively and in terms of our economic stability and employment level.
The Bush administration estimates the cost of cleaning up the nation's air through tighter controls and technology will be in the neighborhood of $21.5 billion. Industry analysts put that figure much higher. Environmentalists say the costs would be more than offset by reduced health care costs. The American Lung Association, in fact, says the annual health care costs from vehicle pollution alone may be as high as $93 billion. Well, talking dollars and cents on this issue of clean air is confusing the issue, says Richard Ayers. Ayers is chairman of the National Clean Air Coalition, representing most of the nation's leading environmental groups and other related organizations, including the American Lung Association. Ayers says we need to keep in mind that this is a health, not an economic issue.
There's been a lot of attempt on the part of industry to focus on cost. There always is. But after all, the reason for the bill is that three out of five of us still live in cities where public health standards aren't met, and we had 11,000 accidents over the last decade involving emissions of toxic air pollution into the air. We have a very serious acid rain program. We've punched a hole in the ozone layer, and the director of the national park says that air pollution is the most serious threat to the park. So I think these are the real reasons for having a clean air bill. We have been falling behind in the fight to get cleaner air, and we need to strengthen the program to make it work. I'm not surprised that industry has complained about costs. They always have, but it is surprising that the president or his lieutenants seem to be so focused on it, since it was just about a year ago the president said we needed to launch a whole new attack on air pollution and said he wanted to be the environmental president.
Though it is hard to tell just where the president himself stands on any of these points, with people like Chief of Staff John Sununu or Budget Director Richard Darman constantly issuing fragments of statements and positions, it is said that the president just may veto the whole bill if it contains the $250 million in compensation. Well, another key difference between the Senate and the House concept of a clean air bill is over alternative fuel vehicles. In an effort to reduce urban smog, the House is proposing to launch a pilot program in Los Angeles to experiment with non-gasoline-powered vehicles. The agreement reportedly came near the end of debate as Democrats backed down from a proposal to implement the alternative fuels program for the whole nation, settling instead for Southern California. By the end of the decade, the House would like to see 300,000 such vehicles plying the streets and byways of the Los Angeles area. The Senate bill has no such requirement. On the other hand, interestingly enough, the House sets up new regulations on the automakers to make vehicles that cut auto emissions by 9% by the year 2000. The Senate, though, is much tougher, requiring 21% reduction by the year 1998. And also a so-called Tier 2 second round of reductions to come later if air pollution has not dropped dramatically. That's in the Senate version. Both chambers are similar in a call for cleaner gasoline. Well, by all counts, the oil and auto industry is mounting one of the most vigorous lobbying campaigns in congressional history. Environmentalists charge that these two industries especially are trying to weaken the bill. The oil and auto lobbies countercharge that the clean air bill is being pushed through by the environmental faction without taking into consideration that the bill would and should involve every citizen in the nation, including big business. Tim McCarthy resents the charges that the auto industry is either unwilling or unable to put a clean fuel, low-emission vehicle on the road. McCarthy is director of federal relations with the Motor Vehicle Manufacturing Association.
What the battle was over in the House was whether or not there would be the mandated production, distribution, and sale of 1 million cars and trucks a year that are fueled by alternative fuels. And our argument against that was that such an effort would not enhance an alternative fuel vehicle program, but could very well kill it. The reason for that, we felt the reason for that, is if you went too far, too fast with such a program, it might not receive a good consumer acceptance for any one of a number of reasons. The vehicles will cost more, the fuel will cost more, the vehicles may not travel as far on a tank of fuel, they may have servicing problems, they might have difficulty starting in cold weather, they may solve one emissions but create another. So, hey, it's a good idea, and let's deal with it, but let's deal with it in an intelligent fashion. In shoving a million vehicles down the throats of a potentially unwilling consuming public may be a way of creating another Etzel, one that people will not buy and actually does no good for clean air.
McCarthy also says that the motor vehicle industry is just as anxious as any group to see a new clean air bill.
Anybody who would portray us otherwise is doing us a gross injustice. And I take issue with a number of the environmental organizations who portrayed the vote in the House as the environmental vote of 1990. We are in favor of further tailpipe controls. We were advocating alternative fueled vehicles long before the environmentalists expressed any interest in this issue at all.
Bill Fay says the Clean Air Working Group has been watching the House debate very closely.
The House bill started out with a very good package. It was introduced by Congressman Hall and Fields from Texas. And that provision really made it, had an alternative fuels program that would work nationwide. And they've made some change to that. We're still assessing to see, you know, whether they've really, you know, really hurt the intent of the Hall-Fields amendment. But it is clearly preferable to what we see in the Senate bill, which is virtually a mandate for ethanol production. Ethanol is a fine fuel, and I don't have anything against it, but it's not a perfect fuel. In a smog non-attainment area, it actually worsens the problem in smog. It helps in a carbon monoxide an area that doesn't meet the carbon monoxide standards, but it actually hurts your problem in a smog non-attainment area. And so ethanol is not only a good move environmentally in those areas, but at the same time, the way that they've mandated in the Senate bill, it's going to add about 10 to 15 cents a gallon to the fuel that you buy. And so there's not an environmental or an economic advantage to it in an ozone non-attainment area, and yet the Senate bill would mandate it for ozone non-attainment areas. So there I think that we're going to find that the House bill takes a little better approach. We hope that the conference committee is going to resolve that and just basically set out a level playing field for alternative fuels. In other words, since there's no perfect alternative fuel out there, let's let all of those fuels compete, and let's find out which one we can perfect to the point that it's the ultimate fuel for us.
Again, an economic assessment. The Senate bill actually does have an alternative fuels program targeting fleet vehicles, buses, for example. Richard Ayers of the Clean Air Coalition says that's a start.
We have, after all, made real steps in controlling pollution from cars over the last 20 years individually. And yet we find that the air is certainly not reached the point where it's healthy to breathe. And the reason for that, I think, is that the automobile is traveling more miles than it ever was before. It's doubled since 1970. And unless we can make it a lot cleaner, we're never going to catch up to the pollution problem. So I think it's very important to have a strong mandate in this bill for the development of so-called alternative fuels or clean fuels. President Bush proposed that last year. He's kind of backed away from it, but I hope he will now put his support back behind that kind of program.
What happens in the conference committee and what comes out of that committee depends on what role the administration plays. Now, more than ever, it becomes a three-way equation. The administration, the Senate, and the House, says Bill Fay, have the same goals, just different price tags.
It's our hope that in the conference committee that the administration and members of the conference are going to try to find the most affordable way to achieve all those goals. Don't change the goals. Let's make those solid, but let's make sure that the American consumer, and American competitiveness is upheld by finding the most affordable way to approach each of those goals.
Ayers says that throughout the entire debate, industry has been trying to argue that a strong clean air bill will put the United States at a competitive disadvantage with the rest of the world.
But I think the truth is exactly the opposite. In the 70s, the United States was the clear leader in pollution control. And as a result, we developed huge international markets for our technology. In the 80s, we have lagged, and at this point, I think most people would argue that Japan and Germany, the two countries that we're most concerned about, are ahead of us in pollution control. I think the new Clean Air Act will be an invitation to American industry to get back into the lead in pollution control technology, which I think is one of the great growth industries of the future. So I think that rather than seeing the Clean Air Bill as a competitive problem, they should see it as a great competitive opportunity.
Depending on who you talk to, expectations as to when the conference committee will be done range from around July 4th to the end of August to sometime in October just ahead of the November elections. For the Environment Show, this is Bruce Robertson. Californians call it Big Green, and 800,000 signatures have been gathered guaranteeing an appearance on the statewide November ballot. Officially, it is called the Environmental Protection Act of 1990, and as Joy Newell reports from Los Angeles, it is considered California's most sweeping environmental proposal ever.
Among its features is the creation of an elected official to be known as the Environmental Advocate. Big Green proposes a $300 million bond issue to buy now privately owned ancient redwood acreage where logging would be banned forever. It also includes a $300 million bond issue for loans and grants to small timber landowners, for reforestation and grants to government agencies, for rehabilitation of publicly owned forest land, parks, and wildlife habitats. Developers of both commercial and residential projects would be required to plant one tree for every 500 square feet of the project beginning in late 1991. David Bunn is the research director of Pesticide Watch, one of a group of environmental groups supporting Big Green. Bunn says the truly groundbreaking part of the initiative involves the regulation and banning of pesticides and the importation of foods grown with banned pesticides. We talked about the organized opposition to the Environmental Protection Act coming from California's massive agricultural sector. He told me about the counter-initiative, circulated for signatures, known by environmentalists as Big Brown. Bunn thinks Big Green will win, but...
Where we can lose, and the chances look far less positive, is that the Big Brown initiative, or the Careful initiative, the agribusiness-sponsored initiative, will also win, and a good chance that it could win with more votes. And if it does, then we really lose.
What happens?
Well, when to the two initiatives, if the counter initiative on the pesticide reforms passes and say that Big Green gets 70% of the vote and that initiative gets 70% plus one more vote or 71% of the vote, it will supersede all the pesticide reforms in our initiative, basically making all the reforms void. So we will, in other words, the opposition has designed a strategy where we can win but still lose on pesticides. And the other side's campaign is they've almost acknowledged that our initiative is popular and the pesticide reforms are popular. They've done that. They've acknowledged that. So their strategy is to fool voters into thinking there's this other measure out there that also makes pesticide reforms, and the challenge to them is just to get more votes. And if they do, we functionally lose the pesticide reform portion of the Big Green Initiative.
Well, and what they say to the marketplace is that if you look at statistics prior to the use of pesticides in the agricultural sector, not only do you see fruit and vegetables that didn't look so beautiful, but people died of other diseases, non-pesticide related. And so they say, you know, the money that you pay, the extra money that you're paying for these crops, which look so beautiful, are in essence just as healthy, if not more healthy, in another way for consumers than what they had, a half century ago, 25, even 30 years ago, when different diseases were taking lives.
Well, first of all, we've grown fine food without diseases, without pesticides, and farmers are doing that today. In fact, some of the most successful growers on the commercial market in California today are farmers growing without these pesticides. And second of all, while the other side is going to make all kinds of scary claims about what our initiative does in terms of agriculture and pesticides, most of these claims are going to be blatantly false. And for example, our initiative is not phasing out all pesticides. It's not taking farmers' tools away from them. It's just phasing out those pesticides that we know to cause cancer or birth defects.
The RIVAL measure is officially sponsored by Californians for Responsible Food Laws. The acronym spells CAREFUL. Actually, if CAREFUL gets one more vote than Big Green, only the pesticide regulations would be affected. But other provisions, such as those dealing with global warming and offshore oil drilling, would be enacted if the votes were sufficient. Big Green would call for the recovery and recycling of ozone-destroying chemicals used in air conditioning and refrigeration. It calls for the creation of an oil spill cleanup fund of $500 million through a 25-cent per barrel tax on crude oil for 6 years. Obviously, the Environmental Protection Act is a story you'll hear more about as we get closer to November. For the Environment Show in Los Angeles, this is Joy Newell.
Next week, we'll have a look at California's model Proposition 65. It's already on the books. Though controversial, it is regulating chemical use in foods and many other products as well. Joy Newell reports for the Environment Show from member station KCRW in Santa Monica, California. Just the other day, my local phone company delivered the new 1990 directories. And when I went to put the new one away, I had to move aside last year's, and the years before, too. Weighing in at nearly 5 pounds each, I now have 15 pounds of books on my shelf. Phone books are difficult to recycle, which is probably why they line up on my shelf, and yours, too. In Tucson, Arizona, where the directories weigh in at 7 pounds apiece, residents do have a way of recycling their directories, thanks to an innovative program run by Tucson Clean and Beautiful. Its director, Joan Leonetti, says after 2 years of shipping the books first to Taiwan and now to Mexico, the program is just catching on.
Is there something about a phone book, the type of print or the way it's bound, that does not lend itself easily to recycling? In other words, why does a recycler that normally handles paper and cardboard and the like turn away from a phone book?
That is correct, because throughout the United States, it's not cost-effective to recycle these books because of the coating on the paper, the inserts that directory printers and publishers put in nowadays, and because of the fact that the glue and the binding has to be removed.
Can you tell us a little bit about how your program would deal with these phone books as they exist, with no changes made by the phone companies?
Well, we still are planning to collect as long as we have a market. It's a real grassroots program. It's very labor intense, and it certainly says something about the volunteer spirit here in the Tucson community, because our telephone directories up until this year were delivered in July, which we're talking about temperatures ranging from 105 to 114 degrees, where our volunteers were out collecting the books at a convenient service store and then transferring them to large roll-offs, which were placed at 15 locations, and then those roll-offs were carted by waste management to the recycler, where they were weighed and then put into containers and shipped on a flatbed to Mexico. So I think as long as we can market these telephone directories, whatever way, we would hope to see them at some point stay within the country. But until that day comes, we will continue to look for any type of market that will keep them out of landfills.
Can you walk us step by step, if you will, from the residential stored in a closet somewhere, the old book gets taken out, and where does it go from the collection point and then onward? Walk us through the step.
First, what we do is we have located a 24-hour convenience store that has 140 locations in the Tucson area, and we have placed cardboard boxes, very large and heavy corrugated Gaylords, at 140 locations. Then we've organized a series of volunteer teams that check these containers on a daily basis for telephone book overflow. And then they transport them, and you can transport them in anything from a Volkswagen to a van or whatever. You don't have to have large trucks to transport these, because all we're doing is removing the books from the top so that they're not overflowing until the last day of the collection. They are taken to very convenient locations with roll-offs. These are these big 40-yard dumpsters that you see located to transport garbage. And they are tossed into that, and then that is transported by the company that donates them, which is Waste Management. And they are taken to the recycler's location, and they are all dropped, and then they are manually loaded either onto a flatbed, which was the case when they went to Mexico, or into a transport container, which was the case when they were shipped by boat to Taiwan. Then at the end, the volunteers are just able to toss also the corrugated boxes right into the transfer container as well, because they're recyclable and removed. So it's a relatively simple program, but totally dependent upon volunteers and a great deal of manual labor.
Now, down the road, what would you like to see done by the printers and the phone companies around the nation that would make the program, the recycling program, collection and disposal, easier?
What we would like to see them do, eventually, there are two issues here. One is the use of recycled paper in telephone directories, which we would like to see, and that is one issue. The other is to create markets throughout the country so that we can look at programs in every community throughout the United States of recycling telephone directories.
Joan Leonetti, Executive Director of Tucson Clean and Beautiful. With the books weighing 7 pounds apiece, she figures that 2.5 to 3 million pounds of paper are being kept out of the landfills in the Tucson area alone. And with paper in general representing up to 41% of our solid waste stream, imagine the result if the whole nation recycled telephone books. About the only negative impact would be that from now on, Dennis the Menace will have to find something else to sit on at the dinner table. And for the Environment Show, this is Bruce Robertson. That's our show for this week. Before we go, a special welcome to new friends listening to The Environment Show on CKON, the Mohawk Nation at St. Regis. The Environment Show is a production of WAMC. Dr. Alan Chartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.